Bradder's No Nonsense Hits.
Well, I have a very special guest joining me today for our Panto special. He's a staple of the Bristol Hippodrome pantomime and has been for many years, but he's also an amazing West Country comedian. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Andy Ford. How are you keeping?
Hello, lover. I'm very good and lovely to speak to you.
So let's go right back to the start where your career began. How did you first get involved with comedy?
Oh, flipping heck. We are going back. Well, this Christmas Eve will be my 54th anniversary as a paid performer. And I did my first gig when I was 12 years old in Exeter in Devon. But starting out then, I was I played the banjo and I sang, and then eventually moved up to guitar and I joined groups, and I eventually went solo as a singer-guitarist. And during these solo gigs, I eventually started thinking, well, I'm going to do something to my voice here if I sing all night long. So I started introducing a few funnies, and I've always loved comedy. I grew up with enjoying The Goons and Monty Python and stand-up comedians from the 70s and 80s, which I also love that style. So I started introducing jokes, and gradually the comedy sort of took over from the singing. And that's why I ended up being a comedian.
Yeah, well, you are the funny man for the West Country, and I will touch upon Panto later, but the reason why I came to watch the Bristol Hippodrome Panto was because of you. Big compliments to you for that. Are there any people that have influenced your comedic style?
Oh, loads. How long have you got? Tommy Cooper was a massive influence on me. Morecambe and Wise I saw live when I was about 11. I'm assuming, because you're a youngster, you know who Morecambe and Wise are,
yeah,
do you?
Definitely.
Yeah, well, they were the staple of comedy, and they were so good, and all the stuff that looked like it was a mistake was brilliantly rehearsed, because they started off doing the music halls in the 50s, just after the war, and they would do two shows a night, 6 days a week in theatres, and it was really tough way to learn how to do your comedy. That's why they became so brilliant. So by the time they got on TV and had their own primetime shows, it was completely honed. And I love that idea of learning your trade and then adding to it when you're in a position to know what you're doing and how to sell the comedy. And I feel sort of a bit closer to that position now myself, because I've done it for so long, but they really were the experts.
Yeah, I think the main reason I know about them is because they did their song Bring Me Sunshine, and when they were on the TV, you used to be like, oh, watch this. I used to find it hilarious when they were doing all the saucepan and the eggs going up and in time and whatever.
You can't learn that in 5 minutes, you know. That takes 20, 30 years to hone that skill. To make comedy look easy is really difficult.
You've told us how long you've been doing it, 54 years, which is immense. Do you still get that buzz going on stage in front of a crowd?
Oh, it's the reason I get up in the mornings. Yeah. And I'm with a wonderful lady, my wife now, of 25 years next year, but we've been together for 32 years. She knows what motivates me. She knows what it means to me. And yes, she's the love of my life, but comedy is also a massive, important love of mine. Yeah. I love writing. In fact, today and yesterday, I've been writing suggestions and little tweaks to this year's Panto.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's a comedic thing, I suppose. Yes, that's a good laugh. But if I choose that word instead of that word, will it be bigger? Will it hit with the audience more? And it's that sort of thing. It's like a learning process that never stops, Jan.
I think it's quite amazing how even just tweaking one little word can just get you more laughs. That really does amaze me with comedy.
Maybe you hold it for two breaths instead of one before you do the tagline. Maybe you take the tagline, which is a punchline. Sorry, that's a bit comedy speak. You take a punchline, and maybe instead of doing it all in one go, you do half of it, get the laugh of that, let people carry on laughing for a while, and then deliver the second half of it. It's all that sort of thing. And the expert on that, of course, was Mr. Ken Dodd. Yes. Genius.
The one man that could go for a gig and make it last 5 hours.
Yeah, but that's because he had all the material honed, and then you double that with his unbelievable confidence, which obviously comes from his success. And when you, for example, when I do a gig and it's sold out, when you walk on the stage, you know that people have just paid to see you. Your confidence couldn't be up anymore because they're there to see you. And Ken Dodd did that throughout his career. So why would he not stand on the stage and believe in what he does? And that's the joy. That's when comedy gets so addictive, is when you know what you're doing is appreciated, and then you can play with it even more. There's a real power and love that comedy gives you, that feeling. And playing, you know, this is my 11th year. I know we're talking about Panto later, but it's my 11th year at the Bristol Hippodrome doing the Panto there. And I know, and I'm sure in my heart, that the people that come to see me, they come to see me because they like what I do and I make them feel happy and they love to laugh with me. So, you know, and my confidence comes from knowing that. And the other joy about playing at, you know, the number one venues around the country in pantomime is that you get to work with people that know, I mean, Craig's not a comedian per se, but he's very confident in his own ability. Yeah. Back to what I was saying about Ken Dodd and stuff. He knows that people like him and therefore he gives them exactly what they want. And same with Leslie Joseph, who's honed her comedy over so many years. Okay, it's different than stand-up, but she started off in the theater, so she knows how to deliver and how to project her voice and stuff. And her timing was immense. So standing on stage and doing comedy with Leslie Joseph was a real, real gift.
So you completed your autumn tour in October this year, which was 2023, of course, and the reviews were raving. How did it go for you?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. It's that thing again where you go out and know that people want to see you. And, you know, I can't do a complete brand new show every year because you have to bed material in with an audience. So I try and vary the material in as much as I won't do the stuff that I did last year, this year, but also I've got to write some new stuff because that's important for me as a comedian. So I had about 2 or 3 brand new routines this year, which I put amongst other material that people love and love to see me do. It's strange with comedy, but when audiences really love a gag, they want you to do it, even though they know how it ends.
Yeah.
So it's that balance of giving the people what they want and some new stuff as well. I'd hate them to think I'm just recycling every year. And plus, it wouldn't be good for me as a comedian. I need to sit down sometimes with a blank page and start writing. I mean, I don't write every gag from scratch. I read joke books and go online, same as everybody does, and find the jokes. But the secret is you find the jokes that make you laugh. And if there's any comedians listening to this, my suggestion would be never do a gag that doesn't make you laugh. But when you find the gag, personalize it. Make it about not just a bloke that goes into a bar, but your uncle who you just argued with that afternoon because he's a Newport supporter and you support Bristol Rovers. So you had this falling out and your uncle went to the pub and then suddenly people can picture who it is. And when they invest in the joke, the punchline is more powerful for them. So it's all those sort of comedy skills really that I need to do every year before I tour just to keep myself motivated and alive as a comedian.
Well, yeah, and of course you're performing it as much as they're seeing it, really. So you have to keep it fresh for yourself, otherwise you get bored of it.
But also at the beginning of the tour, if a couple of the bits that you were convinced were just hilarious don't get anything from the audience reaction-wise, you try and tweak it a little bit, a couple times. If it still not works, out it goes. Mm-hmm. So, you have to be ruthless sometimes as a comedian. I mean, Frank Carson, who was a comedian from Northern Ireland who was massively successful in the 70s and 80s. He once said to me, don't put too many words in before the punchline, which is a wonderful bit of advice. And also, if it's not getting the belly laugh, get rid of it. Yeah. So you got to try and look at the stuff that worked. You know, I wrote some stuff this year that I was convinced was really, really good. And I tried it 3 or 4 times at the beginning of the tour. Didn't really work. So out it went, and I found something to replace it with. And the thing I replaced it with went down great. So it's sort of a learning process, really. As I say, 54 years, and I'm still in junior school.
Yes, of course. I love the fact that you mentioned that, really, when stuff doesn't go right, because I think people think, oh, you're a comedian, stuff always goes right. And really, even you can say it doesn't always go right. You have to tweak it and you have to do stuff to it and you have to make it work for the audience and for yourself, really, don't you?
Yeah, but the difference is now with experience, if something doesn't work, I've always got a get out clause, you know. Yeah. If the gag doesn't get what you expect from an audience, you're straight in with, and this next gag, you'll laugh at even more. I was quite happy with the way you laughed at that one, but wait. So you cover yourself, you cover bases, and you keep talking to keep people engaged. If you do a gag, it falls flat and you leave it, there would be an awkward silence, and then comedians worth their salt never leave an awkward silence unless it really needs it for thinking time for an audience. So there's lots of different techniques involved. But I'll always cover my back, but I'll know in my heart if something hasn't worked properly, and out it goes and in comes something else.
Well, I'm sure you're always coming up with new things, as you said, for your shows and pantos. Do you ever struggle to sleep at night due to thinking of new ideas or do you nerves?
All the flipping time. Drive me, missus, up the wall. I used to have a pen and paper next to the bed and just jot things when they come to me. But sometimes I'll be lying in bed and scare me, missus, to death, and suddenly laugh out loud because I thought of something. What's happening? We got a burglar? So, you can't, as a comedian, you can't really switch it off. I do my best now to know if I'm touring, say I start touring next April and May, which is quite a strong possibility at the moment, I'll try and stop myself from writing until, say, March.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I won't get a life in between. And when I finish Panto at the end of December, I need a come down time because Panto's very demanding.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm a husband and a father and a granddad as well. So I've got to compartmentalize my writing stuff, really. So, yeah, after Panto, 2 months to relax and be me, and then straight back into it and carry on with whatever I'm going to put together for next year.
Yeah, I'd be awful as a comedian, I got to admit, because I'm the type of person that laughs before I've even told the jokes. I know how funny it is in my head. I'm awful for that. But have you ever laughed at your own routine on stage?
Always laugh at it. And especially when I do an ad lib, someone says something in the audience and I come back with something. If it makes me laugh, I think it's quite nice when a comic laughs. I mean, it wouldn't work for a Jack D or someone like that who has a stoic type miserable style of presentation. He has to hold that together for it to be credible. But I'm a silly sausage, and if something makes me laugh, I'll just giggle my way through it. Even on the tags of a joke that I know and the audience laugh, I might just laugh because sometimes a joke can make me laugh every time I hear it. Because it's so well structured and so good, and I'm so pleased and happy at the way I'm delivering and I'm getting the response I want, sometimes that just makes me laugh.
That's the one thing I've always noticed when watching your comedy, is that you're always, I don't know how you do it, you're always happy when you're telling everything. It could be the worst of days and you're just like, let me tell you the next gag, this one's gonna be funny, right? And it's like, it's amazing. Well, I love it.
Yeah, life, you know, life goes on in one thing, but if you're booked to do a show, people don't care what's happened to you in your life. I mean, they would do if they heard, but they're not out for a documentary or sadness. I've gone on stage and I won't mention what's happened, but I've had some tragedies in my life and family life on the day that I'm performing. But the audience haven't paid to see that. They've paid for you to make them feel happy. So make them feel happy is an honor and a privilege, and it pays for my life. So even whenever stuff happens to me, I have to find a way to just go out and do what I do. A lot of comedians, you know, they say have a dark side, and my wife would probably do a slightly different interview with you, you than me. And yeah, it can be a bit of pressure, you know, particularly when you're performing regularly in a touring show or pants or whatever, when you're doing it nonstop, it can take its toll. But I'm so privileged and lucky to be been given this ability to make other people feel happy that I'll never abuse that. I'll always give my best, no matter what's happened. I can put that to one side, go on stage, give them what they want, and then come off and maybe think about the thing that I've got to deal with tomorrow.
Of course. Well, I see a lot of content on social media recently from people, and so many good comments with the tour. It seems that people really do love your style, of course. Now, how have the fans been with you during your career?
Oh, great, really. I think the biggest thing has been, and you set the question, so I'm going to have to say the P word, panto changed everything.
Yeah.
Because as soon as I started doing the big pantos, I mean, I did some touring pantos for a while and they were great for training. But as soon as I started doing the big pantos, people loved it. And the reaction was so good that I would book shows back in the same venue, and the people that enjoyed me in panto would pay to come and see me again. And that's how I've built up a following over the years, really. Most of the, you know, when I work in the West Country, the people that come and see me do my stand-up have, generally speaking, nearly all been to see me in panto.
You know,
and that's where they first discovered Andy Ford. I am getting a lot more like yourself, who first discovered me on YouTube, etc. But then they'll come and see a panto, and then it flows on from there. Yeah. So I tend to play in the areas where people know me and love what I do. And naturally, you get a wonderful reaction from people that appreciate what you do and have paid their well-earned or hard-earned cash to see me do what I do, you know?
Every day
it's a gift and a pleasure, and I'm grateful.
I can tell. You're a very, very grateful man. That's the most important part of being in the industry, really. If you don't appreciate the fans and what the people that have got you to where you are, then what's the point of doing it, really?
And the longer you do it, the more you appreciate it.
Yeah. So you have different comedy staples around the UK. You've got Billy Pearce in Yorkshire, you've got Mike Doyle in Wales. How often do you work with other comedians? How often do you collaborate?
Not often enough, really. We do chat occasionally. During lockdown, I did a whole series of live comedy shows because I had to keep working. So on a Sunday night, I'd go live to all my Facebook followers. And 10 weeks, I did a different show every week. And then I started doing shows, interviewing other comedians about how they keep themselves happy and motivated. And I chatted with Billy Pearce on one of those shows, and he was lovely and generous. And, you know, the great thing is other comedians follow my career as I follow other comedians' careers. And we're all appreciative of what each other does. I mean, it's all different styles, but you can watch Billy Pearce and see stuff that I would never get away with and absolutely love it. Not attempt it, maybe a gag, that's different, but his style is his style. No one does Billy Pearce like Billy Pearce. No one does Mike Doyle like Mike Doyle. No one does Andy Ford like Andy Ford. So it's great when you've honed something and it becomes unique to you, then that's where, back to, you know, the appreciation of the audience, because they know they can't go anywhere else and see this show. In fact, some of my gags and impressions are so bad in a clever way that I actually say to the audience, I'm not worried about other comedians nicking my material. They wouldn't dare. So, you know, being unique has its benefits. It also has its problems. When I used to do cruise ships, for example, no one knew who the comedian was going to be. And because my style is so quirky and different and soft and silly, wouldn't always hit home with the gold and silver dance shoes brigade on some cruise ships. And when I started struggling a bit, I thought, this is not right. Occasionally, I've had a wonderful at night on a cruise ship or whatever. But on a cruise ship, if you don't go well, there's nowhere to hide the next day apart from your cabin. Yeah. And people can be quite ruthless about comedy. In their minds, if something's not funny, you can't fight your corner. I did try to once. But if someone believes you're not funny, that's it. That's their reality. So there's no point in fighting it. So what I did, from having fantastic shows on cruises and then real tough times, I've decided that that genre didn't fit me. So I started doing, like I said, putting on shows in areas where I've done panto and people already like me. And now I only play to people that want to see me. And that is fantastic.
We've got to cover your autobiography that you released, very appropriately named Pantos for Life, Not Just for Christmas. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to write that?
Well, I suddenly thought, I better do it now. You know, I'm 66 now, and it still leaves time for a bit of a sequel. In fact, I can reveal that there should be a sequel coming out next year called Pantos for Life, The Stuff I Forgot. Because after writing it, I suddenly thought, oh, I didn't mention that. And of course, this year I've got to add that I'm working with a Knight of the Realm, Sir David Suchet, and a pop star, Faye Tozer. So who knows what's going to go on in rehearsals and the actual run in Bristol. So hopefully there'll be some stories to tell and appreciation of working with these wonderful people. Plus, there's a lot of stories I forgot to put in the original autobiography. So there's more where that came from.
Well, that's exclusive to listeners now. We've got another autobiography coming out. So if you manage to get one of his normal autobiographies, then next thing you know, you may have the next one. So exactly. That's brilliant. So on the first day that was released, it got up to number one on Amazon under the TV performers category. How did that make you feel?
I was dancing around the front room, mate. My missus said, if you hit number one, screenshot it. So it was number two for quite a while. And then just before we went to bed one night, I think we were up till about 1 or 2 in the morning or something, I said, I'll check it. And I checked it, and there it was, number one. Screenshot it. So yeah, I am an Amazon best-selling author, number one in the charts. So I'm really, really proud of that. Now, I've written loads of scripts and stuff over the years, but it's the first time I've written a book, and I'm really proud. And I've got so many flipping ideas now in my head for other books, not just about my life. So it sort of may have opened the floodgates. Who knows? Watch this space.
The brand new author, Andy Ford. Author, comedian, all-round panto star. We'll just have to make a list now. So where should people buy it?
You can get it on Amazon. Just search Pantos for Life, Not Just for Christmas, by Andy Ford or Andrew Mockford. Either or, you'll find it there. And it's $14.99, and it will get delivered to you within a couple of days.
Yes. Well, the one question that people are going to ask before they buy it is, why should they buy it? So you explain, why should they buy it?
Well, if they're interested in me and what I do and how I do it and why I do it and where I came from and the stuff that went right and the stuff that went wrong and the people in my life that have passed away that I miss and love very much and talk about in the book. If people want to know about Andy Ford's life, how I got to become the guy that stands on the Hippodrome stage and make people laugh, it's there for you. The whole thing is there. As I say, a couple of bits missed out, so there may be a sequel as well. But how I feel, why I do what I do, why I love what I do, it's all in the book, mate.
Perfect. Of course, we are here for our Panto special. That's the reason why we brought you on. So let's cover the main part of your life. When did you first watch a pantomime?
Well, I've probably seen some on TV as a youngster, but I remember taking my children, Alicia and Justin, I think in the 80s, early 80s, to a village hall to see a panto. And I thought, wow, I could do that. That's right up my street. And then from there, we went to see a panto in Plymouth at the Theatre Royal with Danny LaRue and Alan Stewart, who is a brilliant impressionist on TV a lot in the 70s and 80s. Well, he was my hero, you see. When I went to see that pantomime, he ripped the place sideways. I mean, he really did. He was so funny. He did a thing about Michael Jackson and George Formby together with all the Michael Jackson moves, and George Formby's Turned Out Nice Again comedy. And it was just genius. I'm pretty sure he put that together himself. In fact, it went so well that Danny LaRue rang up the producers and asked them to give him slightly less stage time, Alan Stewart, because he was going too well. And I can confirm that because Alan told me that when we worked on cruise ships together, and we ended up being table tennis buddies, because on a cruise ship, you can be stuck at sea for a fair bit of time. And we just struck up a really good friendship, me and Alan, and we played table tennis together. And he told me what happened to him with Danny LaRue. And I can confirm that because it's happened to me. I won't tell you the names of the people that were a little bit, let's just say, trying to stop me from going as well as I was going. It happens. It happens. But if people try and stifle my creativity and performance, I tend to go the other way and go even bigger, because I'll always be respectful and give everyone around me the lines they deserve, and realize that their skills are different to mine and their skills need to shine in the show. That's what makes panto so wonderful, because it's an amalgam of different skills and styles. But if I'm being the lead comic, I got to be the lead comic. I got to be funny. If there's other comics with me, then obviously they deserve to get the laughs as much as I do. And I'll never make it a fight. I'm always happy to set up the punchline for other performers. I like to think that I'm a generous performer, but people that try and, you know, stifle me, I struggle with that, because the whole reason I do this is because I can express who I am. And Alan now is flying. He's been anti-May, and he's like what I do in Bristol and Matt Slack does in Birmingham and Billy does in Yorkshire. You know, we've got the following, and it's given us the opportunity to be popular with the audiences in those particular areas. And that can, you know, as in my case, it can help pay for the other aspects of your career. So it's panto is a gift that keeps on giving if you treat it with respect.
Yes. And I remember watching an interview probably a few months ago with Michael Harrison, and he said, with the comedians, you don't have to have a big name. You have the people who are famous in those areas. So you got yourself, Andy Ford, you got Billy Pearce, you got Alan Stewart, Grant Stott, all of those up in Edinburgh. And you only put them on the poster, and people will buy the tickets because they love them so much. But they're not very famous. They're not like Beyonce or anything. They're just good at what they do, and they've earned the respect of their followers, basically.
And they make sure that every year there's new stuff there, and it's funny and it's strong. And the worst thing that could ever happen is someone come up to watch a panto and say, not as good as last year, was it? Yeah. That would be a dagger through the heart of me. And this year, every year, the show you're about to do is the most important you've ever done.
Well, I have got a question on that a bit later. But first, we have to cover how you actually got into doing it. So, how did you get into it? What was your first panto?
It was a touring panto. I'd wanted to do them for years, and there was an agent in Bristol called John Mills that did a touring panto, and I wanted to do that. I ended up getting a job on a It was an adult panto, touring panto, actually, which is the same format, but, you know, rude jokes and a couple of swear words, which didn't suit me, really, because that's not what I do. But they let me play it as, you know, my normal style. There were a couple of words that I had to say, but, you know, yeah. I got through it. And the joy was, that was my first panto, my first experience of the joys of panto. Following the success of that, I was booked for the family panto the next time it went out. So that was great. And then producers from various companies came to see me. My manager was telling people to come and see me. And eventually I ended up getting a number one theater in Bournemouth, the Bournemouth Pavilion. Oh, yeah. And that coincided with me doing the big talent show on television. So that was a good period for me. And because I had a bit of a profile, more people came to see me. And following that, I went on to do some other big venues. So it sort of snowballed from there. But without that first touring adult panto, maybe the other stuff wouldn't have happened. So I was reluctant to do it because of the language and stuff, but it ended up being really good for me as a way in.
Yeah, well, last year's Cinderella that both Sam and I came to watch was outstanding, and there were a few routines that really made the audience belly laugh, which is always good when you see a comedian making them belly laugh. And it happened to me on the first panto I watched with you. I've never left the theatre feeling so much in pain that I've laughed that hard. But I did when I left Bristol, and I just turned to Dad and I was just like, that was amazing. I need to come again. So do you prefer the physical slapstick routines or the verbal ones?
Now, they're all important because people will only laugh at silly for so long. You've got to give them something to hang their hat on occasionally. And, you know, the physical stuff, which is important in panto, very important in panto, has to work alongside the cultural references and the jokes and the comedy that comes naturally from the characters of the people on stage. So everything is as important as everything else. Yeah. And once again, that's what I mean. I have seen pantos over the years where performers come out and just do 10 minutes each of their act and then try and put a little story around it. But one thing I learned from a wonderful panto dame called Brian Burden was to make the jokes bed in with the storyline. So in other words, like I said earlier about hearing a good joke, but personalizing it. So instead of just doing a joke per se, the reason you're doing the joke is because you're upset with the alderman who's just treated you badly. And you're telling, I don't know, Cinderella or whoever, the story, and the joke comes out of that. So if the jokes can be weaved into the storyline, that makes the joke stronger, and it doesn't distract from the panto per se. In other words, if stuff jumps out as being too gratuitous, then it doesn't really feel panto to me. You can be ridiculous, but that comes out of your character and relationship. So if you don't use the pantomime story as your bolt hole, nothing else that comes out of it work. You have to have that strong base, which is the panto and the story and the comedy and the singing and the dancing, and everything will come out from that base. That's what I'm trying to say.
So you like to write your own material, as I know. How long does it take to write a sketch or a gag, maybe for panto? How long has it taken you?
Well, it all depends, Jan, really. Sometimes, I mean, I tend to, a lot of it happens in rehearsal. I tend to say to the producers when we're rehearsing, I've got a gag that will fit perfectly there. If you don't think it's too long, just let me try it and see what you think. And they'll either say, okay, do it. Yeah, we can fit that in. No, it's too long or whatever. So there is a routine in the show this year that I wrote from scratch. I'm very proud of it. It's been used in thousands of pantomimes around the country. First of all, without my knowledge, may I add. But it's a popular routine now, and it's sort of become like a standard. Yeah. And I wrote it, so I'm proud of it, and I'm doing it for the second time at the Bristol Hippodrome. People won't remember the last time we did it was in 2010, so that's 13 years ago. A lot of the audiences weren't even born. Right. So yeah, that's been included in this year's panto, and I'm grateful for that, because it took that first spark of an idea in my head and the blank piece of paper to write it. So when it works, I couldn't be more proud, really. But I'm also just as keen to throw my ideas in at rehearsal. This occasionally can do some actors Swedes in a little bit, because their disciplines are completely different. They'll turn up having learned every word of the script, and I'll stand next to them at one point and say to the producer, but that line would be funnier. Yeah, but I've learned it that way. Yeah, I know, but it would be funnier if we did this. What do you think, Mr. Producer? And the director comes down on my side and it goes in.
Yeah.
But it, as I say, it's that amalgam of all the different disciplines. But very rarely, I think Les Dennis said the same, Billy Pierce said the same, very rarely do they go into panto rehearsals having learned everything precisely, because it always changes when you add the personalities and the rehearsal process.
Yeah.
And I love that. I mean, that's the bit of panto that is one of the most special things, obviously, opening night and working with an audience. And the pantomime changes over the first week, because the bits, it gets tighter for a start, and the little ad-lib bits that jump in, if they work, they stay. And it's always that balance of improving it but not making it last too long, because people still got their buses and taxis booked. Yeah. So, but I, to be honest, I just love the process of of rehearsal when we meet for the first time. We've had a launch for this year's panto, but we haven't sat down and started to go through script yet. And that's where the magic happens in rehearsal.
Is the script looking good for the show? I'm guessing
it's hilarious. It's hilarious. I mean, there are a couple of bits in there of mine. That's the other skill set for comedians. You can't rewrite everything. You can't. And the writers are good. They're brilliant. The writers for Crossroads Pantos are like the best. They're really funny. The scripts are fantastic. I just, you know, might change a little bit because I speak slightly different to what other people do speak.
Yeah.
So that it would change a little bit there. And you've got to be respectful as well. If someone's worked for years and years, if it ain't broke, don't try and fix it. I keep getting ideas. Sometimes you have to just say to yourself, just stop for a second, Andrew. Everyone else knows what they're doing as well as you. Let's see what comes out. And if it's working and it doesn't need this brilliant idea that suddenly popped in your head, keep your trap shut and let's do it the way it's written, because it's working fine. So sometimes I have that battle with myself, because I'm always keen for things to be funnier and bigger, and sometimes they're funny enough.
Yeah. Well, you've been to many places during your pantomime career, not only Bristol. You've been to Woking, Plymouth, Dartford. But what has been your favourite venue to work at? I think I know the answer for this one.
So there's so many wonderful places I've worked. You know, I've walked out and topped the bill at the London Palladium, which was just an awesome night. I mean, you know, to stand on the stage where Eric and Ernie and Laurel and Hardy, who coincidentally, have both worked at the Bristol Hippodrome as well. Yeah. It has to be the Hippodrome, I think, the Bristol Hippodrome. It's just, and it was created by the same guy that created the London Palladium, Frank Matcham. He's a theatre designer. But yeah, I've worked at Her Majesty's Theatre and Drury Lane and all the, you know, I've done the big West End stuff and, of course, the fantastic Theatre Royal in Plymouth, but also smaller venues around the country, Croydon, Bromley, Northampton, what's the other one? Milton Keynes, where I worked with Henry Winkler, who was the Fonz on Happy Days. And, you know, they're all wonderful places, and I'm so grateful to work them. But when I walk in to the Bristol Hippodrome, it's like I'm coming home. In 2015, I was there with Warwick Davis, and the producers asked me to come back the next year to do Aladdin, but as a dame, and I didn't want to perform as a dame. Yeah. And as it turned out, Warwick and I wrote the panto together for the following year in Woking. So I moved away from the Bristol Hippodrome for about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And then Crossroads and I brought me back to the Hippodrome, and it was the first time I performed there after a gap of about 5 years. I thought, it hasn't changed. It still is wonderful. And the people are still the same with, you know, with me as when I left. So,
yeah,
you know, 11 different shows at that theatre. And I've always had the same dressing room as well, which I absolutely adore. I'm the lucky one, really. Yeah. So I think the Bristol Hippodrome is the place for me.
Yes. Well, last year, and correct me if I'm wrong, you performed to over 80,000 people in the pantomime, didn't you?
I know. Unbelievable. I couldn't even get tickets for my family in the end. It was just impossible. Speaking to the theatre manager for this year, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to come and see our show, get your tickets now, because sales are apparently up from last year. Oh, and we couldn't fit any more in last year, and it's a limited run. So if you want to come and see Sir David Suchet and Faye Tozer and myself and Kerry Dupree, get your tickets now. It's going to be a really funny show. The script is so good.
Yes, good, good. So what makes that Bristol pantomime?
Because it's in Bristol, and the audience are Bristolians, generally speaking. We do get some reprobates from South East Wales occasionally coming across the bridge, but primarily, and you're always welcome. I love Wales. And, you know, people come up from Somerset and Devon and Cornwall to see the show, but primarily it's a Bristolian audience. And they're great for me because although my accent's not completely Bristolian, it's West Country. Yeah. So I feel part of them and they feel part of me. So that's what makes it so special for me. It's where it is and who comes to see it. And add to that, the stage crew and staff at the theatre are so welcoming and lovely to me. And yeah, it's great.
What's it like in rehearsals? Does it get demoralizing when people don't laugh at your jokes?
Well, I've learned, I used to see, when I started off doing panto, I'd try and change the gags every time, you know, just to get a laugh in the room. But, you know, you don't need it because it's really interesting to watch other people's reaction in the show because, yeah, after, they'll laugh the first time you do the gag, but then, you know, when you've done it for the 30th time, it's not going to make them laugh.
Yeah.
But when I go out onto that stage on the first night and the audience have never heard it before, you can sometimes see the reaction on the face of the ensemble and other people in the show that, wow, that really is funny. Yes, yeah. It is. Yes. But you, as a comedian, just have to keep the faith. As we say in the comedy profession, it ain't nothing till you pour an audience onto it. And yeah, then the timing changes, the laughter changes, the power of the gag, and it's a different world. When that's why I say it's important. Panto doesn't work without the audiences, and the audiences are part of the cast.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, it's the audience that make or break a show, really, isn't it? If they don't laugh, you're a bit like, oh, right. And if they do laugh, it makes it even better.
But you've got to know how to conduct them as well, how to give them what they want, make them wait for something. Don't give it to them too early. I mean, you're conducting, really, aren't you? That's what, as a comedian, you build them up, you give them the bits they want, and then you hold off on something that they really want so that when you give it to them, boom, it happens.
Yes, yes. This year, you've got a stellar cast to work with. You've got Faye Tozer, you've got David Suchet, Kerry Dupree, one of the best dames who learned his craft from Danny LaRue, as you mentioned earlier. Are you nervous to be working with David Suchet?
When we met a couple of weeks ago, the first thing I said to him was, "Sir David, it's an honour to be working with you." He just said back to me, "But dear boy, it's an honour to be working with you." And I thought, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that. And yeah, I don't know whether he's Googled me or watched me on YouTube. I know Faye, she says she Googles everyone she's working with to death to find out all about them. But he seems very respectful and lovely. And I just want him to have the best time of his life, because it's the first time he's done panto, man. It's the first time. And of course, Sir Ian McKellen set the precedent for Knights of the Realm doing panto. So why not Sir David Suchet, a wonderful, famous actor all over the world? Do you know, I'm so lucky to work alongside these fantastically talented people with completely different skill sets to myself. It's great. Every day is a day at school.
Have you ever thought before a panto, and I know I thought this before knowing that David Suchet had been put into the panto, have you ever thought, God, that person's going to be awful to work with, and then had a surprise when you've met them?
No one survives in our business without being lovely. I mean, there are one or two people, and I won't mention any names, that have been hard to work with, but they tend not to last very long at the high end of the business, because you have to get on with people and you have to be appreciative of other people, and it's not all about you. Yeah. So I always go in, you know, as an open book and see how it develops. But I know in my heart from our launch the other day with Faye and Sir David and that we just clicked. It just felt really, really lovely. We did a couple of TV interviews together, and it looked like we've been best friends for years. So hopefully that doesn't change and that feeling continues, but we pour on comedy and character and talent, and it ends up being a festival of entertainment. I mean, I'm so excited about this year.
Yeah, I can tell. And I'm so excited as well. From watching you live, I can see that you like to make people laugh on stage, not nastily, like in a jokey way. So what's the best corpse you've had during a show?
Oh, well, year before last, Rob Brinder, who is a lovely boy, a real talent, and is massively successful at the moment, who was Judge Rinder. It was his first panto. And he would I just made him laugh for some reason. I just made him laugh. And every night in the wings, he would say to me, "Make me laugh. Don't tell me what you're going to say. Just make me laugh." And there was a couple of places in the show where I could play around a little bit without distracting from the storyline or shape of the show. So I would ad lib, and he knew it was coming, but he didn't know what was coming. And he would just collapse next to me. And those are the corpses that aren't rehearsed. Sorry to shatter any illusions there. But the natural ones are just the best. And he would just collapse in a heap next to me on stage. And the audience would love it because they knew that I did him with the line. And that's a joy. But you get one, you know, the most important advice I'd say to anyone in thinking of getting into panto, even as a comedian, you don't play with the script, at least until you know it. You have to know it inside and out. Then you can play. You play too early, you'll get yourself in real trouble, not only with directors and producers who will say, "Excuse me, what are you doing to our product?" But also you can lose yourself if you try and play too early. Let's get it down. Let's get it learned. Let's get it right. Then we can sort of, if the audience want us, encourage us to play in certain bits, we can then do that. But you don't play until you know it inside out.
Yes. You were Buttons last year in Cinderella. I may have mentioned that earlier. Of course, it was at the Bristol Hippodrome. But you got a very special ride, didn't you? You got to dress up as a coachman and ride on the Twins Effects coaching horses above the audience, may I add.
Yeah.
What was it like bringing that to life? What was it like? Was it comfortable?
It was one of the greatest things I mean, we didn't soar right up to the top of the theater, but because no one saw it coming and the horses looked so lifelike, and it was just romantic and fantasy, and the little girls and boys' faces, well, the mums and dads and grands and granddads' faces, because I was up so high and we got pretty close to the audience, I could see their reactions up close. It was fantastic. And Lauren and I would say to each other after each show, or after each coach ride, we're the luckiest people in the world, aren't we? Mm-hmm. It's great. Oh, it was great. And Twins Effects are the best.
Yeah.
By a mile.
Yeah, definitely. And you have the music underneath as well. You have Gary Hines music. And you know, as soon as our song starts, you think, this is going to be good. This, whatever's coming, whatever the hell is coming at the end of Act One, it's going to be good. Because
Gary is masterful. He knows what he's doing inside out. He's just and a lovely guy as well.
Yeah, definitely. Would you ever play a villain?
I don't know. Who knows? Is that a comedy villain? Yeah, maybe. But I don't know. I'm still not ready to play Dame. I don't know if I'll ever be ready to play Dame. I just don't think it suits my style. But I'm still loving being lead comic. And the fact that I think Billy's 72 this year, I think, well, I'm 6 years or so behind him. Maybe I'm all right to keep going for a while.
Yeah. You're renowned for creating the song sheet, of course, at Bristol. How do you come up with a new one each year? How long does it take?
Well, I normally write them early in the year. It drives my missus up the flippant wall. It's March. What are you writing panto stuff for? But I have to get the song. When the song develops in my head, I've got to go with it. And it normally develops on dog walks. You know, I think of the next bit, I'll try that. Yeah. What do you think of this show? Do you think it works? You've already did that the line before. Okay. And I just keep, but the tune comes into my head and then the words and then the bits that I want the kids to shout out, because song sheets have changed since COVID, because I used to have the kids up on the stage with me and interview them and get them to do the actions from the stage. Can't do that at the moment. Maybe it will come back. I hope so. But in the interim, I still have the bits for the kids to do, so they do it from their seats.
Yeah.
So once again, I'm a conductor. I conduct the adults to sing the song and the kids to do the shouty out bits.
So
I love it. And I've written so many song sheets now. I think I'm one of a very few lead comics that actually do that. But because I started my career as a singer and in dance bands and playing music, I suppose that's always appealed to me. I've released 3 or 4 albums of my own songs over the years. So I love writing songs and playing and recording and all that. So yeah, I couldn't imagine. I mean, not every song I've ever written from panto has been accepted, but the majority have. And this year's is one of mine, yeah?
Yes, good. We love to hear it. Have you ever had a bad song sheet experience?
Yeah, occasionally something happens and if the kiddie cries, you can't really do anything about that. I think once I experienced an audience go, boo, boo, and I didn't mean to do it. And so, but very rarely that happens. And that's why you have to, when the kids come on the stage with you, you have to let them be the star. You don't get gags on the back of the kids. Yeah. You set them up so whatever they say receives a reaction from the audience. For example, if there's a little girl on stage with you and you say, you're really beautiful, aren't you? And normally they'll get embarrassed or they'll say yes. Either way, that works with the audience. And you say, have you always been beautiful or did it happen last Tuesday?
Yeah.
And whatever they say is a laugh. Always been beautiful? Laugh. Last Tuesday? Laugh.
Yeah.
Get embarrassed? Laugh. So just let the kids be the star. That's, you know, that's the essence of it, really. They're at that point, they know I'm funny. They've seen what I've done. Now it's the time for the kids to shine. And hopefully, maybe in a couple of years, we'll be able to get back to that experience. Yeah. But in the meantime, you know, the song sheets are still a load of fun.
What's the best panto you've performed in so far?
Whoa. The most wonderful moment for me was working alongside Barbara Windsor, because I was part of her contract. We were meant to work together years before that, but she wasn't well enough to perform. And she always said that if she ever did Panto again, it would be with me. And when she came out of EastEnders, I was one of the clauses in her contract. One was a brand new set for the show, and another one was Andy Ford was the lead comic.
Wow.
I love Barbara Windsor. I loved her. It's such a loss, and her husband's such a lovely guy and a good friend of mine. And Barbara used to have the dressing room next to me at the Bristol Hippodrome, and we were just like the best friends. She'd come and sit on my sofa with me, and we'd drink tea and coffee and chat about the Carry On films. And as a young lad growing up, completely in love with this lady, for her to turn into a really good friend of mine and my wife, yeah, and same with her husband, was just probably the best thing that's ever happened to me in show business. You know, it's right up there with shaking hands with Her Majesty the Queen.
Yeah.
In the Royal Variety Show. So I suppose those are the two gems.
The listeners in Wales that haven't seen you in a show may not know your West Country slang. It's very unique. Is there any phrases you could teach us?
Well, girlish means, if you break it down, it always sounds rather confusing. I think they say lush in Wales, don't they?
Yes.
Pretty sure they do. Girt, G-U-R-T, is local slang for great.
Wow. Yeah.
Girt is great, and lush is luscious. So greatly luscious means really nice or lovely. Girt lush, greatly luscious. For some reason, my lover works in Bristol as it works in Devon, where I'm from. But I've always found that fascinating, the colloquialisms, because if you take it, let's just do the left-hand side of the country and go up. If we start in Cornwall, the term of endearment is me handsome.
Yeah.
Then you get to Devon and it becomes my lover. Then you get up to Bristol and it's still my lover. But whereas in Devon, we'd say, hello, my lover. In Bristol, they'd say, all right, my lover. Yeah. Then you go up to the Midlands and it becomes Babs, because you've got Babber in Bristol. Then it, just a little bit further up, Babber changes to, Babber obviously means baby. And then you get to the Midlands and that becomes Babs. All right, Babs. And that just means, all right, Babber, all right, my lover. Then you get a bit further up and that turns to Staffordshire and Stoke and around there. That suddenly becomes me duck.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
You're right, me duck. And you get a bit further up and sort of Yorkshire, Lancashire. But you get up to Scotland and that suddenly becomes hen.
Wow, yeah.
You think duck becomes hen. What do they say in Yorkshire? And I live just above Yorkshire as well. And my wife's a Yorkie. I'll get in trouble for that. But I mean, and on the other side of the country, in the northeast, in Newcastle, it becomes pet.
Oh,
so
yeah.
a duck and a hen could be a pet anyway. So those terms of endearment are great and localized. And I love that. And that's one thing about Panto. Wherever you play, you do your local references. And if you haven't got a great voice for doing accents, which I haven't, I can do West Country pretty good. But if you're working in an area, that's where a lot of actors benefit by doing the accent and the localized language, then you're in. People love it when you reference where they live and work and spend their life every day. It's really appreciated. So I find all that stuff fascinating, but that's almost another interview, that.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely makes a Bristol Panto. You even the pre-show announcement, people, you can hear people cheering. They're like, "Woo, woo!" And you go, "Hello, my lovers!" And it's like, "Oh, it's Andy."
It started. It started.
Yeah. People already. You got them in the palm of your hand there, and they're like, "Oh yeah, we love this now." So we've got some listeners that have asked some questions. Sam said, "Did you enjoy the banter when working with Craig Revel-Horwood in 2022?"
Yes, I flippin' did. He was such a lovely man. And he'd let me wind him up on stage as well, which is always a joy. And he's such a professional, and he knows I'd never take it too far because his skill sets are completely different from mine. It was lovely to see him again, like with Rob Rinder. He'd just fall about laughing when I did a couple of ad-libs. So he was great, yeah. And I did a lovely interview with him, and he was so generous to me. So what you see with the Nasty Craig on Strictly, don't buy that for a second. He's one of nature's lovely people. He's an angel.
Well, the next listener said, has there been a favourite character to play over the years?
Always been Buttons, always will be Buttons. Buttons is my favourite because it's empathy and comedy, and it's sad he doesn't get the girl, but he still loves her, and he's loyal, and he's funny, and he's a children's friend, but he's sort of, after Prince Charming, he's a bit of a hero as well. So yeah, I love him. He's layered. And next to playing Buttons is Mr. Smee.
Oh, yes.
I love Mr. Smee, and that's who I'm playing this year. So it's an honor. I've played it so many times. The different Captain Hooks I've had. Remember the fabulous Sean Canning I worked with, John Altman, who was Nasty Nick Cotton, Paul Michael Glaser, who was Starsky from Starsky and Hutch, Henry Winkler, who was the Fonz in Happy Days, David Hasselhoff was my hook as well, Steve McFadden was my hook, and now Sir David Suchet. So some pretty big names I work with there, and I love being the silly one next to their powerful performances.
Yes. Well, another listener said, what is the most important ingredient for a panto?
Well, it has to be fun, doesn't it? There's too much spectacle, fun, music, comedy, action, lights, everything. Audience participation is right up there at the top. But one producer I remember once, if he would come in and, you know, have a word with the cast, if the show wasn't up to the scratch that he felt it should be, would always give three words of advice: bigger, brighter, better. That advice has stayed with me ever since. Bigger, brighter, better. You can't, those three words sum up what a show should be.
Yes, yes. And finally, Jim said, could you share any tricky moments you've experienced in your panto career?
Tricky moments? Well, I remember once getting to the wings one night and realising, as the music was playing for the overture, that I hadn't put my microphone on.
Oh, no.
I know, and I had to run back in a dresser's, ripping my clothes off and trying to tape a mic to my face, and I just made it. But I think that was the... that was the trickiest moment I've ever experienced, actually. And sometimes, because I'm in my room by myself doing my makeup, putting my costume on, obviously my head was away with the fairies, this particular performance, and to stand there. And I always touch the microphone with my left hand before I go on, just to know it's there. And I always do a sound check with the sound two, who's the guy backstage that tells you your mic's working okay. I always do a check so that I can see that the LEDs on my lights or on my microphone are moving, so I know it's working okay. And I got to the sound desk and I said, can you just test me? He said, nothing. And I touched where the mic should be and I went, oh my God, I haven't put my mic on. Only happened once. It will never happen again.
Well, you can see Andy performing as Smee, or Mr. Smee, I should say, in the Bristol Hippodrome pantomime Peter Pan this season. You can also buy his autobiography, Pantos for Life, Not Just for Christmas. Andy, it's been great chatting with you. Thank you for coming on the show. And all the best for the upcoming season. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. I'll see you there, my lover.